Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Welcome to the forum on the BBC World Service, where we're discussing an ancient philosophy that's currently seeing a huge resurgence. A school of thought over 2,000 years old. It asked how to live a good life in an unpredictable world and how to make the best of what is in our power while accepting the rest as it happens naturally. It trumpeted the value of reason, dismissed destructive emotions as the result of errors of judgment, and offered a practical guide to remaining steadfast, strong, and in control. Yes, I'm talking about Stoicism. In this programme, we'll be discussing some of the key ideas of this influential Greco-Roman philosophy and discovering how it has gone on to inspire politicians, business and military leaders to this day. I'm Bridget Kendall and I'm joined by three experts ready to share their knowledge. Massimo Piliucci, an Italian philosopher and modern-day Stoic. Nancy Sherman, an American philosopher interested in how ancient Stoic philosophy can apply to military ethics. And Donald Robertson, a Scottish philosopher and psychotherapist who draws links between Stoic ideas and the modern psychological approach, cognitive behavioural therapy. Welcome to all three of you. And to start us off, since this is about philosophy with its origins in the 3rd century BC, can you each give us an idea of why it might be relevant to us today by telling us your personal favourite quote from the Stoics? Massimo, can I start with you?
There are so many quotes, but one of my favorite ones is from Epictetus. I'm going to paraphrase it. He said at the beginning of the discourses, if I have to die, I will die when the time comes. But apparently that's not the time right now. So I'm going to go out for lunch instead since I'm hungry.
And
to me,
nice.
that encapsulates the bluntness of the philosophy and especially of Epictetus. It's like, you know, whatever it is. But if I don't have to deal with it now, then I'm going to do something else.
Then I'm going to have lunch. All right. Nancy, what about you?
Well, I'm going to pick from Epictetus as well because he's so approachable. And this is a little bit more about how you manage all the input that comes into your life. It's a bit of a method. He says, you're not really the thing. He's talking to things out there. You're not really the thing that you pretend to be. So look at it. Assess it by all the yardsticks you've got in your toolkit and decide whether it's up to you or it isn't up to you. And if it's one of the things that isn't up to you, be ready to say, it's nothing to me, and walk away from it, essentially. So leave the things behind that are not in your control and try to work hard on what you can control.
That's great. What about you, Donald?
Well, it looks like Epictetus has got the hat trick because I've got a quote from Epictetus as well. And my favorite one is quite a simple one. It is, do not seek for things to be as you desire, but wish for them to be as they are, and your life will go smoothly. And I guess I should attach a little caveat to that, that the Stoics aren't really talking about being passive doormats in life, but learning to emotionally accept things that are beyond our control or that have already happened.
Well, I think that's probably given everyone a little bit of a taster of what the Stoics' beliefs are. Let's look a bit at the history. As we've said, Stoicism was founded in the 3rd century BC, by a man named Zeno of Citium in Athens. Nancy, what do we know of Zeno himself and where he came from?
Well, we know that he came from Cyprus, from Citium or Citium, and that he was a wealthy merchant. And sort of in a tempest storm, he found himself in Athens. He got shipwrecked, and he says this was the most prosperous trip of all. So why was it prosperous? It wasn't prosperous materially, because he probably lost everything on the ship. But it was prosperous because he made his way to Plato's Academy and saw what was happening in Athens. And there he met up with the folks that were sort of after Plato and Aristotle a bit, and you would say they were cynics. And he kind of came to appreciate that there was a non-material world out there that was more predictable or controllable in a way than the world he had as a merchant. He went on to embrace some of those earlier philosophers and really live a stripped-down ascetic life. And then he founded his own school.
And Massimo, these early Stoics developed a philosophy which did provide a unified account of the world and the place of man in it. made up of logic, physics and ethics, yes. Can you just very briefly explain what each of these meant in this context, how they fitted together?
Yes, the most important thing was to study the ethics. The ethics in ancient times was understood as the study of how to live your life, how to live a meaningful life. And so that was the crucial thing to do. But the idea that the Stoics had was that you can't do that unless you're also dealing with other two components. One, they called the physics. It's actually equivalent to what we would today call the whole of the natural sciences, metaphysics, and theology. That is basically an idea of how the world works. How does the world hang together? And then the logic, which also had a more expansive meaning than the word has today, it meant anything to do with good reasoning, not just logic per se, but also including, you know, rhetoric, including what we would today call psychology. And the basic notion was that in order to live a good life, you have to know how the world works and you have to be able to reason correctly about things. Otherwise, you're going to make mistakes.
And Donald, they believed in living in accordance with nature, didn't they?
Yes, that's right. And the Stoics kind of mean three different things by that. They make a distinction between three levels at which they attempted to live consistently and in harmony or at one with things. And one was their relationship with themselves, their own essential nature, which they thought of as reason. So living in harmony with their own capacity for reason or living wisely. And the other was living at one with the rest of mankind, in harmony with the rest of humanity. And then the third was living at one or in agreement with the universe as a whole, which, because they were pantheists, they saw the whole universe as divine. The Stoics see that as being a form of piety, or respecting God or Zeus, living in harmony with the universe itself.
And Donald, the Stoics also talk a lot about virtue, don't they? What do they mean by that?
Well, the Greek word for virtue is arete, and sometimes it's actually translated as excellence. That's considered a slightly better translation because it's kind of broader than what we normally think of as virtue. Virtue maybe seems a little bit of a stuffy term to us today. And it's very much got to do with reason for the Stoics because they're very much philosophers in the tradition of Socrates, where reason is really the most important thing and living wisely in accord with reason. So the Stoics thought that if we can learn to live guided by reason, then we'll flourish and excel. We'll fulfill our potential as human beings. God has given us this capacity, but it's up to us to actually use it properly.
Well, we do know that Stoicism thrived in ancient Greece for some 200 years, and the philosophy later became popular in Rome in about 100 BC. It's the writings and teachings from this late Stoa period that we still have today. And one of the most well-known thinkers from this time was Seneca, the once advisor to the infamous Roman Emperor Nero. Here, in a letter of consolation to his friend Lucilius, he underlines a key component of virtue, the ability to make oneself impervious to fortune.
Most men ebb and flow in wretchedness between the fear of death and the hardships of life. They are unwilling to live, and yet they do not know how to die. For this reason, make life as a whole agreeable to yourself by banishing all worry about it. No good thing renders its possessor happy unless his mind is reconciled to the possibility of loss. Nothing, however, is lost with less discomfort than that which, when lost, cannot be missed. Therefore, encourage and toughen your spirit against the mishaps that afflict even the most powerful. No man has ever been so far advanced by fortune that she did not threaten him as greatly as she had previously indulged him. Do not trust her seeming calm. In a moment, the sea is moved to its depths. The very day the ships have made a brave show in the games, they are engulfed. Reflect that a highwayman or an enemy may cut your throat. And though he is not your master, every slave wields the power of life and death over you.
An extract from one of Seneca's moral letters to his friend Lucilius. And Massimo, there's a sense here of not just preparing yourself to accept what the universe delivers, but also to prepare for the worst, isn't there?
Yes, that's part of the idea. In fact, the standard exercise, even among modern Stoics, is precisely thinking about what might happen in a crucial situation that you're about to face and start with the worst possible outcome. And the idea there is twofold. First of all, if you think about worst outcomes, you can prepare yourself better. But the other one is because you remind yourself that, well, I can deal with that. Even with the worst case scenario, there is going to be a way in which I can deal with it. And in fact, more often than not, the worst case scenario is not going to be the one to actually materialize.
And Donald, there's also a hint in that reading we heard about death not necessarily being a bad thing, isn't there? This alluded to the Stoic view that things we might think of as bad and good aren't necessarily in theirs. Wealth isn't necessarily good. Death isn't necessarily bad. Can you explain that a bit for us?
Yeah, actually, I think it's fairly easy to explain. For the Stoics, life in itself isn't a good. It's just an opportunity. It's the use that we make of it that really matters. So a wise man, a good man, or a woman might use their life well. A bad or foolish person might use their life badly. And the same applies to anything that the Stoics consider to be an external, something that's beyond our direct control, such as health, wealth, reputation. These are all advantages in life, but for Stoics, they're not intrinsically good, because a bad person could use wealth and reputation to do terrible things and exploit those things, whereas in the hands of a good person, they might be turned to good use.
And Nancy, the Stoics did take a particular view on emotions, didn't they, which they referred to as the passions.
They were deeply cognitivist. So they had this view that emotions such as fear or appetite, we might say lust or distress or pain, really are judgments or beliefs about those external goods that we've been talking about fear in the case of a threat that's out there, a bad in the offing, or appetite, something desirable that's out there. And they try to tell you that the emotion or the passion is what you make of those external goods. They're not the external goods themselves. It's you that makes that judgment. So they have this view that you can control your emotions, not by the external goods to which we attach, how you gloss those sorts of things in terms of your own judgments.
And doesn't Seneca write about anger, saying this is a particularly destructive emotion?
Yeah, On Anger is one of the most wonderful books there is. It's an essay on how it can just ravage mankind, do all sorts of things, cause you to throw your servants into a pool of sharks, we might say, if that poor servant breaks a crystal goblet. You lack control, and the way to be able to control that anger is to realize that you have an impression, a fleeting appearance of a bad that's out there. But you can change your belief about that bad. It wasn't so bad after all. It was an accident. The person didn't mean it. Or it's nothing to me. What does it really matter if I have one fewer crystal goblets in my dining room set? And you then rethink the emotion through the reconsidered judgment.
Well, this is a good opportunity for us to introduce Epictetus, a former slave who lived in the first century, and he had a particular view of how negative emotions are begot in the first place, and a theory of how we might avoid having them.
Men are disturbed not by things, but by the views which they take of things. Thus death is nothing terrible, else it would have appeared so to Socrates. But the terror consists in our notion of death, that it is terrible. When, therefore, we are hindered or disturbed or grieved, let us never impute it to others, but to ourselves, that is, to our own views. It is the action of an uninstructed person to reproach others for his own misfortunes, of one entering upon instruction to reproach himself, and of one perfectly instructed to reproach neither others or himself.
An extract from Epictetus, Enchiridion, or Handbook. Donald, what's he trying to say with this, do you think?
Well, actually, he's trying to say something very special, and it's something that people have found to be a revelation throughout the centuries, right down to the present day. He's saying that it's our opinions about situations that determine whether or not we're going to be upset about them, and in fact determine our strong emotions in general. And the Stoics would go a little bit further than that when they're being more specific and say it's actually our strongly held value judgments about external events that cause us to be upset about them. That's really what he's driving at there. And it's interesting that he mentions Socrates as his example, because in fact this idea goes back further than Stoics, all the way back to Socrates.
And Stoicism has been associated with the notion of the stiff upper lip, hasn't it, when emotions are played down. But from what you're saying, Donald, this passage suggests something a bit different.
You know, we should probably distinguish between what we sometimes call uppercase and lowercase Stoicism. So the word Stoicism, when it's used in modern English with a lowercase s, kind of means having a stiff upper lip or being unemotional. But ancient Stoicism, the school of philosophy with a capital S, means something much more sophisticated. It has a more complex psychological theory. And part of that is that the Stoics think there are good, bad and indifferent emotions, to put it simply. So they think there are unhealthy passions or emotions that we should learn to deal with. But rather than simply trying to suppress those, we should challenge the underlying beliefs that cause them and transform them into healthy emotions. The Stoics call those eupatheiai. And there are also a third class of emotions that they talk about, or precursors of emotion. They call those the propatheiai. And these are our involuntary emotional reactions. Seneca talks about them in On Anger. When you're first reacting to a situation that you're surprised by, you might feel your blood pressure rising. And that's not really a fully fledged passion. It's not entirely under your control. So the Stoics say, rather than struggling against that, we should accept it as natural and inevitable and view it with indifference. It's the aspect of emotion that's under our voluntary control that they think we should do something about.
Massimo, Epictetus was also famously known for what's referred to as the dichotomy of control, making the distinction between what is in and what is beyond our control being key to a clear judgment, which relates back, I suppose, a bit to what Donald's just been saying.
Epictetus made this pretty sharp distinction between things that are under our control and things that are not under our control. And he makes a list of the things that fall into either category. The things that are under our control essentially are our judgments, our opinions, and the values that we choose to adopt. And the things that are not under our control is pretty much everything else, particularly everything that is external. And external includes things like my reputation, my wealth, even my own body. The idea in the first case, in the first group, the things that you control, you're responsible for whatever you think. And therefore, you have the duty to reflect on what it is that you adopt as your beliefs and what it is that you adopt as your values. Everything else, like for instance, say, let's take our body. It may seem strange to say that our body is not under our control, because you can say, well, what do you mean? I can go to the gym and exercise. I can eat a healthy, diet, and that is under my control. Yes, but ultimately, you can influence the state of your body, but not ultimately control it. All it takes is a virus, like the one that I got yesterday, for instance, and you're knocked out, or an accident can break your leg or something like that. Now, what derives from this distinction? Well, the idea is that if, in fact, the only things that are under your control are your judgments, your opinions, and your values, then that's where you should focus. The rest, you should just take it as it comes.
Nancy, we know that Epictetus was a former slave, and the fact that he was once a slave and then became a philosopher is actually entirely in keeping with Stoicism, isn't it?
Yeah, the Stoics are fascinating in this regard. They are really the authors, going all the way back to Diogenes, of cosmopolitanism, where we're all equals in a certain way. We all have a certain amount of that shared rationality, shared reason that's in the universe. So we have bits and pieces of that, and enough to make us equals in a certain way. So a slave in a certain way is an equal to a rich man, and a rich man or rich woman is equal to a slave. And that becomes very important in a political philosophy that comes out of Stoicism. It's a kind of enlightenment in a funny way.
Now, we also know that Epictetus was a key inspiration to another important Stoic writer who was from an entirely different Roman class, a general and a Roman emperor, no less, Marcus Aurelius. Nancy, tell us briefly a little bit about him.
Well, it is an irony of history that a general should be inspired by a slave. True, a slave who was more we would call a hostage, a slave of war. But nonetheless, Marcus Aurelius was very influenced by Epictetus. And Marcus Aurelius, though filled with power, privilege, and status, and led troops, nonetheless felt that in order to be virtuous, he needed to practice Stoicism and did. And so in a remarkable graphic picture of history, he's leading troops in campaigns along the Danube. And at night in a tent, he writes literally meditations to himself. He didn't expect them to be published or for anyone else to read them, but they were self-improvement thoughts at the end of the day. They're often about diminishing your sense of power and realizing that honor is just something outside yourself that you can't easily control, as we've been saying, that reputation depends on many things other than yourself. So it's your judgments and opinions that matter. And he, too, very much thought that my body and limbs are just one part of a larger whole, and so too everyone. And if we cut ourselves off, one from another. And so he's got to mean, too, a general from the most lowly infantry person, then you're no longer really thinking of yourself as fully rational and as a part of that reason. So he's writing all this while this huge golden statue gets marched out every day in a chariot to remind and inspire the troops that they are the troops of this magnificent emperor and general. But he himself is writing about diminishing the sense of self in these meditations. I think it's quite remarkable.
Well, as well as encouraging us to dwell on the shortness of life, Marcus Aurelius also believed in preparing oneself for others' unpleasantness and meeting it with that famous Stoic equanimity we were hearing about.
Begin the morning by saying to thyself, I shall meet with the busybody, the ungrateful, arrogant, deceitful, envious, unsocial. All these things happen to them by reason of their ignorance of what is good and evil. But I, who have seen the nature of the good, that it is beautiful, and of the bad, that it is ugly, and the nature of him who does wrong, that it is akin to me, not only of the same blood or seed, but that it participates in the same intelligence and the same portion of the divinity. I can neither be injured by any of them, for no one can fix on me what is ugly, nor can I be angry with my kinsman, nor hate him. For we are made for cooperation, like feet, like hands, like eyelids, like the rows of the upper and lower teeth. To act against one another, then, is contrary to nature. And it is acting against one another to be vexed and to turn away.
An extract from the Meditations by the Roman Emperor and Stoic Marcus Aurelius. Now, as we already know, Stoicism flourished in the Greek and Roman world up to the 3rd century, after which Christianity became the dominant religion in that part of the world. Massimo, what do we know of the influence Stoicism had on Christianity?
Quite a bit, actually. In fact, one of the reasons a lot of Stoic ideas sound familiar to modern ears is because they influenced Christianity in one way or the other. So with the rise of Christianity, we actually have the end of all the Greek-Roman ancient philosophical schools. The last one to close down was the Academy that was originally established by Plato. But pretty much all of them, little by little, disappear. The Christians got, of course, mostly the ethics from the Stoics, not so much the metaphysics, although the Gospel of John, for instance, starts out with the famous phrase, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God. And the term Word there is actually Logos, which is the same Greek word that the Stoics used to indicate that the universe itself is rational.
And I suppose all these ideas about believing in your inner world and not taking too much notice of the external world, that's quite familiar, isn't it? That we shouldn't pay too much attention to the temporal world outside us.
It is. In fact, Epictetus' manual was used as a training manual for spiritual exercises by Christian monks throughout the Middle Ages. The only difference is that every time that Epictetus mentions Seneca, they change it to Jesus. Several of the major leading figures years of sort of Christian theology have been more or less directly influenced by the Stoics, beginning with Paul of Tarsus, who arguably was responsible for putting Christianity on the map to begin with. Much later on in the Middle Ages, we have Thomas Aquinas, and Aquinas put together the modern list of seven Christian virtues, and four of those seven are the same as the Stoic virtues, practical wisdom, courage, justice, and temperance, to which he added the three more Christian ones of hope, faith, and charity.
And Donald, there appears to have been some overlap with Buddhism as well.
Yes, that's right. There are similarities and differences between Stoicism and Buddhism, but I suppose some of the main similarities are the Buddhist concept of non-attachment is kind of similar to the Stoic idea that we shouldn't invest too much value in external things and we should always view them as transient and beyond our direct control. And also the Buddhist concept of mindfulness has some parallels in Stoic psychology. The Stoics have this idea of prosoche, or attention to your own mind. So a kind of Stoic mindfulness, if you like.
And if we travel forward from the ancient world, Nancy, Stoicism also saw a revival in the European Renaissance, didn't it, when it was known as Neo-Stoicism. How did that happen?
Absolutely. So Montaigne, sometimes called the French Stoic, he wasn't that much of a Stoic, but he was very influenced by the idea of meditations that could be helpful to one's self-improvement, and he thought of virtue as more that you could develop a temperament to be able to deal with externals and things that happen beyond your control. The most famous, in some ways, descendant of Stoicism who's had really, really lasting power was Kant, Immanuel Kant.
The later, German philosopher of the 18th century.
Exactly. So it's later than the Renaissance philosophers. He very much viewed the idea of that reason is inherent in all of us. This was part of the Enlightenment idea, and that we were authors of our reason. So he didn't accept the idea that we were parts of a larger pantheistic God, but rather that we were nonetheless all co-sharers of the same kind of reason, and that we, as a result, could be authors of our moral lives, legislators of the moral kingdom, of the kingdom of ends. So he very much secularized the Stoic thought.
Well, it seems that throughout the ages, Stoicism has had its followers, and not least those undergoing extreme hardship. Much more recently, in 1965, James Stockdale, then a senior US Navy pilot, was shot down over Vietnam during the US war with Vietnam. He would become a prisoner of war there for over 7 years. And here he recounts how Stoicism, in particular the works of Epictetus, helped him through some of those very dark days.
Everything I know about Epictetus, I've developed myself over the years. It's been a one-on-one relationship. He's been in combat with me, leg irons with me, spent month-long stretches in blindfolds with me, has been in the ropes with me, has taught me that my true business is maintaining control over my moral purpose. In fact, that my moral purpose is who I am. He taught me that I am totally responsible for everything I do and say, and that it is I who decides on and controls my own destruction and own deliverance. Not even God will intercede if he sees me throwing my life away. He wants me to be autonomous. He put me in charge of me. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishment the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul.
A reading from James Stockdale's Stockdale on Stoicism. And Nancy, what do we know of Stockdale's relationship with Stoicism?
Well, Stockdale is an amazing figure, and I had the privilege of spending time with him, interviewing him at very long intervals. He was shot down as a young Navy officer, and he had been given Epictetus, the little handbook, as a parting gift by a philosophy professor at Stanford, where he was doing a master's degree. And he joked, saying, what would a martini-drinking, golf-playing naval aviator need with a book like this? And he put it aside. And when he was on board the carrier called the Ticonderoga in the Straits of the Mekong Delta in that area, he memorized it. And he said, as he was shot down, 5 years down here at least, and I'm leaving behind the world of technology and I'm entering the world of Epictetus. And True to form, it became his salvation. This idea, as the quote we've just heard suggests, of minimizing what's outside your control, even in torture, even in 2.5 years of solitary confinement. For him, he often said it was sort of being in prison was almost like a silver lining in a life, that he learned the usefulness of Stoicism, even in moments, as you could hear in that quote, when he flirted very seriously with suicide.
Donald, these lessons of resilience from people like Epictetus were to go on to inspire a psychological approach which we might today associate with cognitive behaviour therapy. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. So Stoicism preempted modern psychotherapy, remarkably so. And in fact, wasn't until the 1950s that Albert Ellis, who's one of the pioneers of modern cognitive behavioural therapy, he developed an approach that he called rational psychotherapy. And nowadays it's known as rational emotive behaviour therapy, or REBT. And Ellis was a psychoanalyst, like a lot of people at that time, and he was becoming disillusioned with the sort of Freudian or post-Freudian approach. And he decided to kind of start again from scratch and reinvent psychotherapy. He'd read Epictetus and Marcus Aurelius, and those were some of the things that he drew upon, some of the major influences in the development of this new rational or cognitive approach he came up with. And the real importance of the connection between Ellis and subsequent cognitive therapy and Stoicism is that they share an underlying premise, which we call the cognitive model of emotion. Actually, we mentioned it at the beginning of the show, I think. It's the idea that our emotions aren't somehow just completely separate from our thoughts and beliefs and value judgments, but that to a large extent, our strong emotions are determined by the type of value judgments that we make. And those are beliefs that, importantly, could be true or false, and therefore we can learn to evaluate them, to question them, and to change them. So modern cognitive therapy, from Ellis onwards, uses an approach that they call Socratic questioning, and the Stoics used this technique of Socratic questioning as well to help people reflect rationally on their beliefs as a way of transforming their emotions.
Well, indeed, while Stoicism might have been around for over 2,000 years, it does continue to inspire thinkers throughout the ages. And we now have today the founding of the modern Stoicism movement. With its current popularity, you can live like a Stoic for a week, you can attend an annual conference, you can become a Facebook member of a local group, listen to podcasts from all over the world, buy books on Stoicism, and see its application in sport and business and politics. Henry Manampiring is one of its converts, and he spoke to us from Indonesia about how he first became interested in Stoicism.
I came across Stoicism last year. I was on my lowest point of my life. I was just diagnosed with clinical depression. So last year I went into a bookstore and I found a new book on Stoicism. And when I read it, it was a really eye-opening experience. The philosophy helps me identify the sources of my anxiety and stress and depression. So we attach our happiness to things that actually are not our control. So this philosophy reminds you to focus on things that are under your control. For example, Jakarta is notorious for its traffic jam. And I used to be very, very irritable when I felt stuck in traffic. I would lose my temper, I'd become angry, I bang on the dashboard. After I learned Stoicism, I realized, what's the point? The traffic is totally out of my control. It is totally irrational to be angry about it. And I'd rather use my energy and my mind on something else that are more beneficial rather than cursing on the traffic.
Jakarta-based Henry Manampiring, a modern Stoicism convert. And Massimo, you're a practicing modern Stoic yourself, and you've written a book called How to Be a Stoic, using ancient philosophy to live a modern life. So what are the sort of things that you do, and what's been the effect of practicing modern Stoicism on you?
There are a number of things you can do. Some of my favorite ones include the evening diary, the evening philosophical diary, which is essentially, I guess, inspired by the meditations of Marcus Aurelius, although both Epictetus and Seneca explicitly describe these kind of exercises. And what it is before you go to bed, you write down, you reflect, and you write down on some major things that happened during the day, things that are important in terms of your own personal ethics. And you ask yourself three questions. First of all, what did I do wrong? Second, what did I do right? And third, what remains to be done?
Sorry to interrupt, but how do you decide what's right and what's wrong?
So I think of Stoic philosophy as a moral compass. The Stoics give you certain ideas about what is right and what is wrong, right? So the dichotomy of control is a first entry into what is right and what is wrong. The only things that are wrong are bad judgments and bad values, and the only things that are really good is good judgments and good values. But also, we mentioned the four virtues. And one of the virtues is justice. And justice, the Stoics understand as, you know, treating other people as human beings, you know, fairly, as you would like to be treated. So anytime during the day I don't treat somebody like that, let's say a colleague or a student or a friend or something like that, then that's one of those things that I did wrong.
Massimo, how far do you take being a modern Stoic? I mean, do you go in for cold baths, for example?
Yes, I do, actually. Cold showers. Not every day, but I do. The Stoics did a number of self-deprivation exercises, such as taking a cold shower or going out in cold weather, you know, without a coat, or fasting, for instance. The notion is that if you actually deprive yourself temporarily of some things, then you actually will appreciate the fact that you have them on a regular basis. But at the same time, you want to remember, you know, want to remind yourself that not everybody on earth has a hot shower and, you know, and a meal. So it's a way to sympathize also with people who are deprived of these things. And the third reason to do it is because you can remind yourself that you can, in fact, endure these kind of situations. I mean, there is a little bit of a component of endurance in Stoicism.
Nancy, what do you make? How do you make sense of this resurgence of Stoicism in our modern era?
I think there's a need to take more control of your life, especially as we're subject to so many more influences outside. I do think that being more resilient in the face of what you can't control is certainly an aspiration we all have. I worry a lot about the way in which the focus on an individual and an individual's strength and an individual's endurance minimizes the contributions to our social well-being and mental health of the societies we grow up in. How you draw the borders of what's inside and outside your control when you realize how networked an individual you are and how dependent on things outside yourself you are is problematic.
Well, we're running out of time, I'm afraid. So just one final question to you all, very briefly. Having reviewed the ideas of Stoicism, can you give us one concept from the philosophy that you think it would be most useful to take away with us? Donald.
Yeah, I'm going to go big. I'm going to go for the view from above, as it's known, which is a technique that we find mentioned quite a lot, actually, in the meditations of Marcus Aurelius. It really involves looking at events in terms of the bigger picture. And I like it because modern psychological research tends to show that when we're angry or anxious, our attention narrows down and our thinking becomes biased and very selective. So resilience can be seen as the opposite, a broadening of a perspective that views things in relation to a much wider context. So I find that a very profound, very rich exercise in Stoicism.
Nancy, what about you?
Well, I think of the idea that Marcus Aurelius had that he got from an earlier writer named Heracles, and that is that we're in the middle of a series of concentric circles, and our job as members of the largest community we can imagine is to keep bringing one circle closer to us, and then the next outer circle, and then the next outer circle, and the circle after that, so that in a way you reduce the distance between the circles. And I think that's a lesson for me about fighting tribalism, because the psychological mechanism by which you bring those increasingly more distant circles to your center is a kind of empathy, a kind of way of trading places in time and in space. And I think the Stoics' cosmopolitanism, we are citizens of the universe, they said. That's the lesson for me I'd like to remember.
Massimo.
I think a very important lesson is this idea that our lives are worth living regardless of external circumstances as so long as we do our best. So it doesn't matter if you're wealthy or poor or educated or ignorant. Those things don't have anything to do with your moral fiber. So long as you try to do your best, helping others and being a good human being, that's all that matters. At the end of your life, you can then look back and say, yeah, that was a life worth living.
Many thanks to all three of you, Massimo Pigliucci, Nancy Sherman and Donald Robertson. And that's all from me, Bridget Kendall, and the rest of us on the Forum team for this week. Goodbye.